taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were every day American.
What does a 2020 Georgia Supreme Court case have to do with a 1900 case about a dead officer? Plenty. A report about a case decided by the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia this past December highlights the importance of knowing your rights. In the 1900 case the Georgia justices used in their opinion, we see that this knowledge can have life or death consequences. Both cases show the importance of knowing your rights and being prepared to assert them, especially in the face of government actors. Our story begins with the Georgia case Glenn versus the state. In the evidentiary hearing conducted by the trial court, both testimony and body camera evidence was presented. Quote, on May 3, 2018, an Athens-Clark County police officer responded to a suspicious person call in the area of Oglethorpe Elementary School shortly after students were dismissed at 2:30 p.m. The responding officer drove around the school property in his patrol car, and for a few seconds he saw Glenn walking on the inside of a line of trees and shrubbery that bordered the road behind the school. The officer testified that he radioed to his dispatcher that he was getting out of his patrol car with a subject matching the description given by the initial 911 caller. The responding officer approached Glenn and called out to him, "Let me talk to you real quick." Glenn asked if he was being detained. The officer responded yes, ordered Glenn to stop walking and to sit down, and radioed for backup. Glenn, who remained standing, asked the officer why he was being detained and said, "I'll tell you my name. It's Christopher Glenn. I'm walking home." The officer told Glenn that he was conducting an investigation and that if Glenn moved, he would be charged with obstruction and, if he tried to flee, the officer would use force if he had to. Now, shortly after backup arrived, Mr. Glenn was handcuffed, searched, and told he was going to have to take a seat in the patrol car. Mr. Glenn asked, "I want you to tell me right here, what am I being detained for?" One of the officers told him for a suspicion of a crime, a sexual assault against a minor. Mr. Glenn told the officer that he was dehydrated, so medical personnel were called, and Mr. Glenn was placed in the treatment area of an ambulance. The supervising officer ordered Mr. Glenn to be removed from the ambulance, stating he would be evaluated by jail personnel. Mr. Glenn refused to exit the ambulance, and the officers physically dragged him to the door, where Mr. Glenn flung himself toward the officers, headbutted the supervising officer, then went limp. When the officers tried to get him into the patrol car, Mr. Glenn kicked and struggled, falling onto another officer and knocking him down. Continued attempts to get Mr. Glenn into the patrol car were met with similar resistance. At one point, the supervising officer knocked Mr. Glenn to the ground. At another point, Mr. Glenn damaged the door of the patrol car. Eventually, the officers were able to get Mr. Glenn into the patrol car, where they tied his legs, secured his feet to the floor, and then took him to jail. A day after his arrest, a warrant was issued for Mr. Glenn's arrest for violating the conditions of his probation by committing new offenses, loitering and prowling, obstruction of a law enforcement officer, and interference with government property. 2 weeks later, Georgia filed a petition to revoke Mr. Glenn's probation because of these offenses. At a hearing on the revocation of Mr. Glenn's parole, the state of Georgia argued that Mr. Glenn committed the offense of loitering and prowling by walking along the wooded edge of an elementary school as the school was being let out. That Mr. Glenn committed the offense of obstruction and interference with government property by physically resisting in multiple ways at multiple points in time while being detained pending further investigation of the reason for the officer's dispatch. The state also argued that even if Mr. Glenn's arrest was unlawful, meaning he did not commit obstruction, he was still guilty of damaging government property. Mr. Glenn argued that the evidence shows that the responding officer did not have probable cause to arrest him for loitering and prowling, thereby making it legal for him to resist an unlawful arrest. Now, when the case went to trial, we read, quote, the trial court determined that the evidence did not support a finding by a preponderance of the evidence that Glenn had committed the offense of loitering and prowling. Specifically, the trial court found that on May 3, 2018, the officer did not observe Glenn in a place at a time or in a manner not unusual for law-abiding individuals and found that there was no evidence of any circumstances of the type listed in the applicable status as to warranting alarm for the safety of persons or property in the vicinity. The trial court noted that the officers involved failed to give Glenn, prior to arresting him, an opportunity to explain his presence and conduct so as to dispel any alarm or immediate concern which would otherwise be warranted. The trial court also determined that the evidence did not support a finding by a preponderance of the evidence that Glenn had committed the offense of obstruction because there had been no basis to arrest Glenn for loitering and prowling. Game, set, match, yes? No. Quote, but the trial court found by a preponderance of the evidence that Glenn had committed the felony offense of interference with government property by damaging the patrol car. Specifically, the trial court found that even though Glenn's arrest for loitering and prowling was unlawful, he had no legal justification for damaging government property once he was in handcuffs and sitting in the patrol car. Now, the case was appealed, but the Georgia Court of Appeals found that while Mr. Glenn did have the right to resist with force his unlawful arrest, the amount of time that lasts between being placed in the patrol car and damaging the vehicle was too long, and that since his reaction was not immediate to his arrest, the damage was an intentional act. At this point, the case was appealed to the Georgia Supreme Court, whose opinion went into a lengthy description of the history of legal resistance to unlawful arrest, and the opinion of the court read, quote, generally, under the common law, a person cannot be punished for fleeing from or physically resisting an unlawful arrest or escaping from an unlawful detention, so long as the person uses no more force than is necessary to achieve such purposes. See United States v. DeRee. The Georgia court based its opinion on the case United States v. DeRee, which in turn was quoting a 1900 case, Bad Elk v. United States. The Bad Elk case questioned whether someone could be charged with murder for using lethal force to avoid an unlawful arrest. Reading from the syllabus of that case, quote, three policemen in South Dakota attempted, under verbal orders, to arrest another policeman for an alleged violation of law when no charge had been formally made against him and no warrant had issued for his arrest. Those attempting to make the arrest carried arms, and when he refused to go, they tried to oblige him to do so by force. He fired and killed one of them. He was arrested, tried for murder, and convicted. Now, interesting, during the trial, the judge charged the jury, quote, the deceased, John Killsback, had been ordered to arrest the defendant, hence he had a right to go and make the attempt to arrest the defendant. The defendant had no right to resist him. It is claimed on the part of the defendant that he made no resistance, and he was willing to go with the officer in the morning. I charge you, of course, that the officer, John Killsback, had a right to determine for himself when this man should go to the agency with him. In this connection, I desire to say to you, gentlemen of the jury, that the deceased, being an officer of the law, had a right to be armed, and for the purposes of arresting the defendant, he would have had the right to show his revolver. He would have had the right to use only so much force as was necessary to take the prisoner, and the fact that he was using no more force than was necessary to take the prisoner would not be sufficient justification for the defendant to shoot and kill him. The defendant would only be justified in killing the deceased when you should find that the circumstances showed that the deceased had so far forgotten his duties as an officer and had gone beyond the force necessary to arrest defendant and was about to kill him or inflict great bodily injury upon him, which was not necessary for the purpose of making the arrest. In short, the judge all but ordered the jury to find the defendant guilty because, as a law enforcement officer, John Killsback had the right not only to arrest the defendant, but to use force to do so, even though the order he was given was unlawful. In other words, this judge instructed the jury that you, as a citizen, are a subject to the whims of law enforcement, even if their actions are unlawful. Now, let's examine that claim for just a minute. The Fourth Amendment reads, quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. You have a right to be secure from unreasonable seizure. In neither the Bad Elk case nor the Glenn case did the arresting officer have a warrant or direct observation of a crime. In both cases, we see a law enforcement officers ordering the arrest and seizing people without any legitimate reason to do so. And in both cases, we see an expectation that citizens are subjects of law enforcement, expected to shut up and do what they're told, even if what is happening to them is illegal. In the Bad Elk case, we further see judicial malpractice when the trial judge tells the jury that a law enforcement officer has the right to make an illegal arrest. Thankfully, in both cases, the courts eventually came to the right opinion. What can we learn from these two cases? Well, first of all, we should recognize that we, as free citizens, are not subjects of the state. A government official, even a law enforcement officer, does not have the right to make an unlawful arrest. That as free citizens, it is our right, or as I would say, our duty, to resist such unlawful seizures with all of our abilities. Now keep that in mind when you see videos of people standing up for their rights, breaking into their own businesses that were illegally boarded up, or resisting arrest for not wearing a mask. Second, we need to recognize that the courts are not the solution to all of our problems. Yes, in both these cases, the correct opinion was eventually handed down, but that was only after years of fighting for their rights. Imagine yourself at the defendant's table when a judge instructs the jury that you do not have the right to defend yourself against an illegal arrest. Then remember all of the court opinions that said government can infringe on your rights if they have good reason to do so. Lastly, these cases show how important it is that we know our rights and how to defend them properly. Not simply by asserting your rights with law enforcement, but having the ability to assist in your defense should you be the victim of unlawful actions by government officials. What's the old saying? Knowledge is power. I brought you these two cases because it's an important point that I want to bring up. We are not subjects of government. Most of the constitutions of the states declare that all power is inherent in the people. Law enforcement, in fact, any government official works for us, not the other way around. A badge, an ID, or a government paycheck does not make them rulers. And it's an important thing to understand. Now, I'm not saying what happened in the Georgia case was the perfect way to answer this problem, but it does show that the courts, even the Supreme Courts of both the state of Georgia and the United States, recognize our fundamental right to defend ourselves against illegal actions, even by government actors. The Badel case even takes it a step farther and says it explains why, one of the reasons why it's so important that our right to keep and bear arms is protected. It's not so we can go out hunting Bambi. It's so we can defend ourselves from an armed, out-of-control government, whether that be a military action or that simply be an overzealous law enforcement officer. But the other thing it should bring to mind is a quote that I use from John Jay. It's what I founded the Constitution study on. See, John Jay says, every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. That's what I try to do. But the reason I try to do that is the rest of the quote. See, by knowing their rights, they will sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. That's what we saw in the Georgia case. It appears Mr. Glenn recognized pretty much immediately that his rights were in jeopardy. His rights were being violated. The first question out of his mouth was, am I being detained? That's an important piece of legal knowledge. If a law enforcement officer is detaining you, they have to have probable cause. Not either they have to have witnessed you or have a good reason to detain you, or they have to have a warrant, which is the good reason to detain you. He stated, I will give you my name, I'll tell you what I'm doing, but it was all based on recognizing right off the bat that his rights were in jeopardy of being violated, and shortly, very shortly, they were. Now, whether or not the way he handled the problem, again, that's a discussion for another day. I wasn't there, I don't have all the information, I certainly wasn't in this man's head. But it's an important point to recognize why it's so important to read and study the Constitution, to know what your rights are, to recognize that quickly and that easily that your rights are in danger. The next part was to defend and assert them, recognizing that he was being unlawfully arrested and apparently having previous experience with law enforcement. Decide the best way to defend his rights is to resist an unlawful arrest. That was his right. And I'm glad that after who knows how long, he finally got the legally justifiable answer that, yes, you can resist an unlawful arrest. But for my listeners, I want you to think one step forward than that. because the idea that you can resist an unlawful arrest is more than just you can resist an unlawful arrest. It recognizes that your rights are paramount, that your right to be free from unreasonable seizure isn't justified based on a government saying, I've got good reason. Desiring to speak to someone because he looks like a description that someone gave for a person, it would warrant investigation. It would even warrant going up and asking him a question. It does not warrant detention. And it certainly doesn't warrant arrest. From the same standpoint, recognizing what just because a government official shows up at your door or at your place of business doesn't mean they have the legal authority to search and seize. Your rights still matter. But if we don't know what our rights are because, well, let's face it, we're not taught the Constitution, most of us don't recognize when our rights are being violated. So the first thing I wanted to do is kind of bring to mind this idea that we are not subjects of government. Law enforcement doesn't have the legal authority to rule over us. They have to follow the laws. They have to follow the rules. It's important to recognize that. I'm kind of curious, and if anybody knows, please let me know. Contact me through the website. What happened to this officer? Because what the officer did was a crime. All of the officers involved. You unreasonably detained a person. You had no probable cause. That was shown in court. They had no probable cause to detain this person. They committed a crime. In fact, they committed a federal crime. 18 U.S.C. Section 242. It is a federal crime under color of law to deprive someone of a right protected by the Constitution of the United States. What happened to the officer? See, that's the other part of the puzzle here. We talk about defending our rights, and we talk about being vindicated in court. Well, what happens to the perpetrator? I don't know. But it made me think, and it made me go through some news articles, and I've got quite a few sitting here at the moment, about situations where individuals, or in some cases, governments, stand up against illegal acts of other governments. Let's start with the owner of a Vermont shooting range who's being fined nearly $50,000 for having unpermitted buildings. In other words, buildings government didn't approve of. Now, I have an issue with most zoning laws. Now, my biggest problem is it denies people the control of their property. Now, I can see certain regulations that involve structures that impact others, right? Structures that are open to the public, and structures that are and zoning rules that are purely designed for the safety of people outside of the building, right? I can sort of kind of see a reason for that, right? I don't like living cheek to jowl to people, but there are neighborhoods where, you know, you're packed right in together, and having some method of redress for the bad actions of a neighbor that directly impact you, you know. If your neighbor is running the grass grill in the living room and sets his house on fire, and burns yours, that's pretty bad. But a lot of these zoning regulations are just ridiculous. Which toilets you use, how many outlets you have, it's crazy. So here we have someone who's he's got a shooting range, which means he's got to have room. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but shooting ranges are not usually people packed on top of each other. The shooting range is separate from neighbors because, well, bullets tend to fly. And I'm not familiar with what exactly the zoning violations that this person had, but apparently he built buildings without getting the permission of government. Now, again, it's one thing to say, listen, if you build a building, there are certain minimal requirements that you have to have to ensure the safety of your neighbors is one thing. To say you have to come to us and get permission to build a building is a deprivation of property under color of law. Well, apparently, a Vermont environmental court judge, Lord in heaven, what is an environmental court judge? These are supposed to be laws, these are supposed to be courts of justice, not environment. But the judge ordered the owner, Daniel Benai, to immediately dismantle any unpermitted structures. Benai said no. They've done nothing wrong. They haven't done anything illegal. Unless they can find a problem with the structure, the government has no legal authority to tell you what you can and cannot do with your property. The government doesn't have the authority, legally, constitutionally, to tell you whether or not you can build a structure, only to have what civil liberty infringements are necessary for the safety of others. So he's standing up. He says he's refusing to pay the fine. He's refusing to tear down the buildings. He's going to stand up to this illegal order. Now, this again, I don't have all the details. This sounds like a patriot standing up for their rights, for someone saying, no, the state of Vermont doesn't have the legal authority to tell me whether or not I can put buildings on here, only that I make sure that they're safe for the neighbors. So if you're in Vermont and can help Daniel Benai out, please do. If you can go to his events, if you can stand with him in court, please do. This is a scenario where he's standing up for his rights and it, by extension, for the protection of your rights. So please stand. If you want to help him financially, I'm sure there are ways of doing that, but it's important that when people stand up for their rights, that we not leave them alone and abandoned, that we do our part to stand with them. As Franklin said, we must all hang together or we will hang separately. Here's a man who's hanging. Is he doing so alone? Are there people with him? I hope so. I'm no longer in the area, so I can't I can't physically go there, but I do try to support him, and I hope his case comes out well. But again, remember, you're asking a government entity, in this case, the court system of Vermont, wholly owned part of government, one of the branches of government, to find another branch of government created by to create another part of the same branch of government created by another branch of government to do what's right. Do you see a conflict of interest here? We're asking one court to tell another court you've done wrong, a court that was created by the legislature. The deck is stacked against him. So if we can help him, if we the people, the holders of the power can help him, we should. And I would encourage all the patriots in the New England area that can to stand with him, and anyone that can provide assistance for his fines and his legal fees, I'd appreciate if you did that as well. That is part of what we must do if we are to remain the land of the free, is we need to stand up with those who are defending freedom. Because when they defend their freedom, they're defending our freedom. So before I head off to break, I want to remind you, you know, we spent almost a year and a half dealing with this virus and COVID-19. And we're going to spend the next several months, if not more, dealing with the push for the vaccination. But if you really want to protect yourself against not just COVID, but the flu, a common cold, or just the crud, we need to eat right. We need to have a healthy immune system. And one of the things we can do is use healthy cell vitamins to help boost our immune system, as well as things like sleep better and have more focus. So head over to healthycell.com/outloud, get 20% off your first order. You can try the REM sleep to get more sleep. You can do what I do and take the Immune Super Boost to help keep my immune system healthy and strong. The best thing is you don't have to take a bunch of pills. It's a simple gel. You can either shoot it or mix it in a drink, but check it out. Again, that's healthycell.com/outloud for 20% off your first order.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
AmericaOutLoud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You joined the Constitution Study, and we're talking about how to deal with unlawful government actors. Now, we spent the morning talking about a couple of cases and situations where individuals stood up against illegal actions from government. But you see, we don't understand. Checks and balances are not simply the three branches of government. Our states are there to check against not only the bad actions of the federal government, but also bad actions of other government entities, other parts of the government. So let's start with this idea of what are called no-knock warrants. Now, as I understand it, the idea behind a no-knock warrant is if you are serving a warrant on someone who is so dangerous that the advanced warning of knocking on the door, identifying yourself as law enforcement, and then telling them you've got a warrant, those few seconds can make the difference between life and death, not just for law enforcement, for the subject as well. So I look at these and I say, well, I can see a situation where this might be a safety measure. But I also see the other half of the coin. Imagine you're the person in the house. Your door gets kicked in. People with guns, frequently with body armor on, come charging in, yelling and screaming. In many cases, possibly not even identifying themselves as law enforcement. What's your first reaction? See, it's important that we look at both sides of this because those who are very pro-law enforcement said, well, it's a tool that is needed. And I can see a scenario where it is truly needed. You know, if you're trying to apprehend a suspect who has not simply been accused, but has a history of violent response to law enforcement, who has previously shot at or otherwise endangered law enforcement, I could see where those few seconds of tactical advantage would be important. But I also see the other side, because sadly, no-knock warrants have actually been executed on the wrong house. So again, due process means protecting the rights of the individuals involved. So my first thought being, if we're going to use a no-knock warrant, you must prove to a judge that a no-knock warrant is absolutely necessary. There must be a documented history of not simply accusation, but conviction for violent crimes, especially against law enforcement. There must be a recorded history of this person that they would be an extreme danger to anyone trying to serve a warrant. But you must also allow for the other side. If someone kicks in the door, you cannot blame them for shooting back. If someone kicks in my door, my first response is to pull a gun and fire. Now, you can come in yelling and screaming, law enforcement, you know, police, police, police. How do I know you're really police? Have I seen a badge? I mean, if all it takes is to yell police, police, police to get someone to stop protecting themselves, how long do you think before criminals will start kicking in doors, yelling police, police, police? Now, a couple of states are looking at this. Both Texas and Connecticut are having committee hearings on the idea of prohibiting no-knock warrants. So there are two states that are looking into, do we still want these? Now again, I don't live in Texas, I don't live in Connecticut, but I hope any of my listeners in those states will recognize that it's not a simple black and white question. If you prohibit no-knock warrants, you are giving criminals a tactical advantage in a potentially life-threatening situation. On the other hand, if we allow no-knock warrants to be used indiscriminately, you are endangering the lives of innocent citizens. Now, here we have two states, and again, they're looking at committee hearings. I'd love to hear what experts are looking at, what comments we're getting from, you know, from law enforcement, from defendants or their lawyers, or simply constitutional scholars. Hey, if someone wants me to come talk to them, I'll be more than happy to, about understanding all of the ramifications of no-knock warrants. It's a power that is so dangerous to all involved that I don't know that I would want to see it completely gotten rid of, but I certainly want to make sure it is used solely as a last resort. To me, it is that important. Continuing the theme of police, I have another couple states. Here we have a bills in both Maine and Massachusetts that are looking for a way of ending qualified immunity for police. Now, if you're not familiar with qualified immunity, I don't blame you. It's not exactly talked about that much. But the general idea is if a law enforcement officer is believed to be in good faith executing the laws properly, they cannot be held civilly liable for their actions. Now, there's a certain logic to that, but the problem we have there is a basic violation of a petition for redress of grievance. In other words, it adds a layer of protection for law enforcement that other people don't have. Now, in Maine, it's interesting, the Maine bill, which is LD 1416. It's interesting because in Maine, it is legal for people to sue law enforcement under state law for, quote, using or threatening to use physical force or violence against a person in violation of the Constitution of Maine or the Constitution of the United States of America. In other words, you have the legal right to sue. But the problem is, officers can claim qualified immunity. So LD 1416 would eliminate qualified immunity as a defense to liability for claims brought under state law. In other words, if a law enforcement officer acted in a way that you believe used force that was in violation of the Constitution of either Maine or the United States, you can sue them, which you've always could, but now the officer doesn't. Today, the officer can come in and say and claim, I have qualified immunity. I was I was following orders, or I honestly believed that what I was doing was right. Now, I've covered qualified immunity on the website before, and one example I love to use, because it's just one of the most blatantly ridiculous opinions of the courts. Law enforcement was in pursuit of a criminal. The criminal jumped the back fence, the fence into a backyard where the family was having an outing. The police followed them, which is legal. They are in hot pursuit of a felon. That is a reasonable entry into onto private property. It's what's called an exigent circumstance. At gunpoint, they ordered the fleeing person to freeze. They ordered everybody to the ground. Everybody complied. Entire family got on the ground. The family dog came out of the house concerned, wondering what's going on. The dog was not threatening, did not growl, did not charge, did not bite. Some family member told the dog to go back in the house. Dog went back in the house. Dog comes back out. Again, the dog did not growl, the dog did not charge, the dog did not bite. However, law enforcement shot the dog, and in doing so, injured a child. So the family sued. You killed the family dog, you injured the child, and the courts found that since no court had stated explicitly that killing a pet and injuring a child while in hot pursuit is a violation of the law, of the Constitution, the police could not be held accountable. Now, the court literally said that the police would have no way to realize, they didn't say that what they did was right. He said the police would have no way to realize that shooting a dog that is not a threat to them was illegal because the court hadn't said so. Forget the Constitution of the United States, forget the Constitution of the state, forget just common sense. The court said they'd have no reason to believe that because we hadn't told them so. And the law enforcement officers got off. Now, if this were to happen in Maine today, yes, you could take the police to court, but you'd have the same situation. They'd just claim qualified immunity. So Maine wants to get rid of that option of qualified immunity. The Massachusetts bill, which is H-1479, says basically the same thing. It says that although people can sue for, quote, an alleged act or failure to act which constitutes a violation of the civil rights of any person under federal or state law, H-1479 eliminates qualified immunity as a defense. So if you get sued civilly, not criminally, civilly, you can't simply say, well, I have qualified immunity because I'm law enforcement. So I like both of these bills. In fact, I'd like to see these bills in more and more states. Because what we have is a legislature, part of the state government, looking at what's happening in their state saying, this is wrong. Now, those people say, oh, Paul, are you anti-police? No, I am very pro-police. I'm pro honest police, and I believe most law enforcement officers, they're great people. They're doing a dangerous job, frequently for little pay, long hours, hard work. And if they do their job right, protecting the rights of the citizens in their region, I'm all for it. What I dislike, what I hate with a passion, are law enforcement officers that violate the law, that abuse the citizens they have sworn to protect, and then allowed to get away with it. One of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence talks about protecting troops by mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. Well, is this really any different? When law enforcement can be protected by a concept, not a legal, not a law, a judicial opinion from the consequences of their bad actions. Is this really any different than protecting them by a mock trial? The trial becomes mock. It's useless. So I'm very much for these laws. Now, there's another whole series of laws, and Idaho is recently given us an example that wish to stop executive actions, illegal executive actions of the president. Now, for example, Joe Biden has issued, and let's not pretend this isn't political party wrangling, but Joe Biden is looking at executive orders to impose unconstitutional, therefore illegal, gun restrictions. So a House panel in the Idaho legislature has approved legislation to head off at least half a dozen executive actions from President Biden, specifically to deal with gun control. But Paul, federal law is supreme. Don't you remember that? The Supremacy Clause. Whatever Congress says is supreme over the states. No, see, there's a sad part. Unlike apparently most judges and most politicians, I've actually read the Constitution, and I can quote to you Article 6, Clause 2, which says, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land." So the Constitution is supreme. Only laws of the United States made pursuant to the Constitution are also supreme. By the way, executive orders, nowhere to be found. Because executive orders are not law. They're not even rule or regulation. They are directions to the executive branch. So no, this isn't a supremacy clause issue. This is a state's rights issue. A state's rights issue, Paul? Yes. Anybody here remember the 10th Amendment? You know, that pesky little thing that says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by to the states are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people? Anybody remember that? So when a power not delegated to the United States, specifically the power to regulate firearms or to regulate any arms, right? Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So since that was not a power delegated to the United States, and since it's actually prohibited by the states, the right is reserved to the people. So when Idaho or any state stands up and says, listen, what you're doing is wrong, it's unconstitutional, therefore it's illegal, therefore we will not stand for it within our state, people go, oh my God, it's anarchy. It's nullification. It is nullification. It's legal nullification. You see, the states aren't subject to the federal government. It's the other way around. I know, I just shocked a whole bunch of people. But if you look at the Constitution, the states were created before the federal government. The states created the federal government. Therefore, the federal government is subject to the states, not the other way around. Article 7, the ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. See, the Constitution is an agreement between the states, and it created the federal government, and it set boundaries on the federal government, as confirmed in the 10th Amendment. So when states look at the illegal actions of part of the federal government and says, no, they are not being disobedient to the law. They are upholding the law. They are doing their duty to protect the citizens of their state. So, good move, Idaho. As long as you can prove those actions are unconstitutional, which is really pretty simple, since it's infringing on the people's right to keep and bear arms, and since it was not a law passed by Congress, I'd have to look at all the executive orders. The orders themselves may not be illegal, but what they tell the different executive agencies to do may be illegal. I know, subtle but important difference. It is important that we recognize that the states are not powerless before the federal government. Now, I have another article here, and this one's sad. Well, a lot of them are sad, but apparently Ashley Babbitt's family is suing the U.S. Capitol Police for $10 million. Now, if you're not familiar with the January 6th event, which, by the way, I wouldn't be surprised since it's been misrepresented so horrendously in the media. I was a Jefferson said nothing, you know, simply being included in that polluted business is enough to make it not worth trusting. But Ashley Babbitt was one of the people that entered the Capitol. By the way, we now have video evidence that they were not prohibited by the Capitol Police. They were invited. They were allowed by the Capitol Police. She was shot and killed by Capitol Police. And apparently the law enforcement officer who did this is not facing criminal charges for wrongful death. Again, I'd love to see the evidence of how she was an imminent threat of death or serious bodily harm to anyone. So now the family is suing for damages, $10 million. Now, I have no problem with the family suing. They have suffered a grievance, and they are looking to the government for a redress of that grievance. My biggest concern is you basically have the federal courts that are going to hear this case against a federal Department of Justice and the federal Capitol Police. The deck is stacked against the family of Ms. Babbitt. But the idea that no criminal charges were filed disturbs me. Even if it's found that the officer is innocent, not even filing charges, I'm suspicious. I don't know what the circumstance, because I wasn't there. I've seen no evidence of what was there. But based on what I've heard, what Ms. Babbitt was doing was not a threat to anyone. And this, to me, seems almost like another version of immunity, of qualified immunity. Oh, yes, you shot and fired someone, but you killed someone. But because you're in law enforcement doing a job, maybe we should let you get away with it. Again, I don't know, but it certainly is suspicious. All right, let's get back to some other things here. Florida has passed an interesting law. And not surprisingly, it's being challenged in court. See, Governor DeSantis signed into law HB1, which basically is designed to protect the rights of people from those who are protesting. It's called the anti-riot bill. And the idea is it increases penalties for criminals conducting criminal acts of violence during these protests. So it's not targeting the protesters. It's saying, listen, if you are, if you, let's take the BLM and all that out. Let's say you have a demonstration. You're doing a protest. You've got a peaceful protest. We can call it a mostly peaceful protest. And in that protest, some people show up and they start looting. They're attacking people. They're breaking in. They're committing arson and they're looting. HB1 is designed to enhance the penalty. So the fact that your peaceful demonstration was taken over, or at least used by violent criminals, we kind of want to, don't we want to punish them? If you're breaking in, if you're doing damage, if you're assaulting people, if you're killing people, does that follow under the First Amendment? No, not even close. Now, interesting, the people that are challenging this bill claim it's a violation of free speech. First of all, this is a state law, so it's not a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment starts out with Congress shall make no law. Congress didn't make this law. It's not a First Amendment issue. But there is a free speech clause in the Florida Constitution. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but I know it's there. I've seen it. But your freedom of speech doesn't give you the authority to loot and steal and damage and assault. Again, your First Amendment or your freedom of speech, regardless of where you're using it, doesn't give you the authority to damage other people's property, to steal. That is irrational. They're also claiming it's a cruel and unusual punishment. Really? It's cruel that if, that, you know, again, I'm always weary about sentence enhancements. Things that say, well, if you do this crime to this person, it's one thing. If you do it to another person, it's something else. I have issues with those. And I might see an issue with this as well. I haven't seen all the details of HB 1, but the general idea that it is a freedom of speech issue or a cruel and unusual punishment to punish people for committing violent crimes shows the hypocrisy and stupidity of some of these people. Yes, I said stupid. That is ignorance combined with hubris. The very idea that freedom of speech includes the ability to commit a violent crime is irrational. The very idea that getting punished, now again, I don't know what the punishments are. Maybe there is a punishment that's too much. I haven't seen it. As I said, I'm always weary of sentence enhancements. But this is nuts. This is the crazy stuff that we're dealing with. So if you, they basically are saying if you commit a violent crime while you're protesting, well, that's protected speech. That's stupid. I'm looking for the next suit because Oregon, yeah, that lovely bastion of tyranny, is now requiring workplaces, businesses, and religious sites to show proof of COVID vaccination to allow people maskless on their property. If you own a store, if you own a business, your customers, your employees either have to show their papers or wear a mask. And I've seen it. They are already being sued because the people are standing up and saying, no, you cannot force us. You cannot deprive us of control of our property. That's the important part. It is a Fifth Amendment protection. I don't care where else it's protected. Fifth Amendment, Constitution of the United States, so you will not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. You have no legal authority to deprive someone of the control of their property unless you've shown they've done something wrong. Something that damages others. Not simply, oh, we want people to wear masks. Well, too bad. I don't care. It's time people stand up. It's time people simply, not simply sit back and go, oh, that's terrible. Stop being keyboard warriors. Let's stand up and let's stand up and support the people that are standing up for us. Like this lady, Katie Bossie, a Sunday school teacher in New Hampshire, who was arrested for daring to attend a school board meeting without a mask. I hope she sues the pants. Actually, I hope more than this. Yes, sue the pants off. Don't sue the pants off. You know what you do? You file criminal charges. Pick up the phone, Ms. Bossie. Call the FBI. File a complaint. They have deprived you of your liberty in a public place without due process of law. They have violated the Constitution of the United States. If they point to a state law, that's the 14th Amendment, not the 5th Amendment. They have violated your rights under color of law. The people on the school board should face charges. I've had enough with, well, we just want to point out that it's wrong. We want the moral. I want people individually punished for denying us our rights, for breaking the law. So let's say you sue the school board. Okay, the school pays for it. So you just pay taxes to a school district to give you money back because members of the board did something wrong. At least they should lose their jobs. This should be a no-brainer. But we don't think that way. We're taught to comply. We're taught to do what we're told. It's time for people to stand up. And it's time that we stop trusting that government will protect us from government. For example, Governor Newsom in California. This tyrant who shut down churches, who shut down restaurants and businesses, who determined whether or not you were worthy of continuing your job, was charged with violating the law about abusing his emergency powers.
He expanded mail-in voting in direct violation of not only the Constitution of California, but of the United States, since it involved a election for the President of the United States. And guess what? An appellate court, the Third District Court of Appeal in Sacramento, opined. I know the article I said ruled. They don't rule. They opined that the lower court erred in interpreting the Emergency Service Act to prohibit the governor from issuing quasi-legislative orders in an emergency. Where are your rights when the judicial branch of the state of California will let the executive branch of the state of California simply trash the laws and constitution of your state? It's time to stop waiting for the government to fix itself. We must do that. We must recognize we have the legal authority, we have the moral duty to take control of our governments and combat these unlawful acts coming out of there, to stand up to those who are acting illegally, to hold them accountable, and to do it not one-off, not onesie-twosie here and there, but to stand up together, to stand up, to hang together in regaining control of our governments. Otherwise, we will hang separately as those governments come for us. If you wish to be the land of the free, if you wish to live at liberty, then it is time you start standing up and acting like it. And even if you're not the one standing out front, support those who are. Now, if you have a topic you would like me to cover, or if you have a question you'd like me to answer, go to constitutionstudy.com. In the menu, click Ask a Question, fill out the form, and I will answer the best that I can. I also want to remind you that my shows typically go to podcast a couple of days after they're heard on the radio. You can hear them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, and iHeart. And please do me a favor, leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps get the show out to other places. So please do that for me. And then one more thing, come back next time for the Constitution Study.
Paid bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends.